This is Richard Aidy coming to you on RN from the Sydney Writers' Festival. Our next session is an excerpt from an interview with Booker Prize winner Hilary Mantel, who spoke by satellite from London with Michael Cathcart, my colleague. Unfortunately, the satellite link quality wasn't great, so even though the conversation was wonderful, we're just giving you a segment this afternoon. Here's Michael at the Sydney Theatre Company.
We're here to meet Hilary Mantel. Hilary writes novels, short stories and criticism. In fact, she's written everything from personal memoir to historical fiction. And according to some commentators, she's the best English writer working today. That was certainly the judge's decision 3 years ago when they awarded her the Man Booker Prize for her novel Wolf Hall. Well, as I'm sure we all know, she's back. There's a sequel, it's called Bring Up the Bodies. We're back in the court of Henry VIII, and the book traces the rise and fall of Anne Boleyn, all of it occurring under the watch of the very wily Thomas Cromwell. Would you welcome Hilary Mantel? Hilary, welcome. You look as though you're sitting on a roof somewhere. Where on earth are you?
Sadly, Michael, hate to disillusion you. Just a backdrop. I'm in a perfectly ordinary studio near King's Cross.
Before a cunning photograph.
Exactly. This is the City of London behind us. Somewhere down there is what was Thomas Cromwell's house, right at the heart of the financial district, just at the back of the Bank of England.
How marvellous. We're all picturing that in our mind's eye. You know, it'd be great to set the scene, if you wouldn't mind, by hearing you read a little bit of the novel. And I suppose you could set it up for us. One thing we all know, sure, those of us who've read your work, is that when you use the pronoun he, you're often talking,
yes,
about Mr. Cromwell.
I'm usually talking about Mr. Cromwell, unless I tell you different. Yes, in this passage, near the beginning of the book, we're in autumn 1535, and the royal party is at Wolf Hall in Wiltshire, which is the home of the Seymour family. The king is there with Cromwell, a hunting party. The daughter of the house is Jane Seymour. Henry already knows her. She's a lady in waiting. She's been around the court for several years. Plain Jane. And suddenly, Henry's focused on her, as if he's seeing her for the first time. So what's happening here? Could this be the beginning of the end of Anne Boleyn? And is Jane to come in perhaps as Henry's mistress? Or even a new wife? It is to be their last night at Wolf Hall. He comes down very early, his arms full of papers. Someone is up before him. Stock still in the great hall, a pale presence in the milky light. Jane Seymour is dressed in her stiff finery. She doesn't turn her head to acknowledge him, but she looks at him from the tail of her eye. If he had any feeling for Jane, he can't find traces of it now. The months run away from you like a flurry of autumn leaves, bowling and skittering towards the winter. The summer has gone. Thomas More's daughter has got his head back off London Bridge and is keeping it, God knows, in dish or bowl and saying her prayers to it. And he, Cromwell, is not the same man as he was last year. And he doesn't acknowledge that man's feelings. He's starting afresh. Always new thoughts, new feelings. Jane, he begins to say, you'll be able to get out of your best gown. Will you be glad to see us on the road? Jane is facing front like a sentry. The clouds have blown away overnight. We may have one more fine day. The early sun touches the fields, rosy. Night vapors disperse. The house is waking up. Unstalled horses tread and whinny. A back door slams. Footsteps creak above them. Jane hardly seems to breathe. No rise and fall discernible of that flat bosom. He feels he should walk backwards, withdraw, fade back into the night, and leave her here in the moment she occupies, looking out into England. Jane is in a way the most far-sighted of them all. She knows what's going to happen.
Hilary, for those who came in late, perhaps you could tell us who Thomas Cromwell is.
Thomas Cromwell was the son of a blacksmith and brewer, born so obscurely that we don't even know his date of birth. He rose to be Henry VIII's right-hand man, minister of everything, at the centre of Henry's court, for the decade of the 1530s, when England was remade. And the question that drives my books is, how did he make that transition, the blacksmith's boy, to eventually the Earl of Essex? How did he do it?
We know a lot about his public life from the historical records. How much do we know about his private life, though?
So very little that there's never been any satisfactory biography of Cromwell. He was a guarded man, and it's hard to say whether the records never existed or whether he erased all traces of himself behind him. But you really have to look hard, you have to read between the lines to find Cromwell the private man. But I'm driven by a belief that he is there. The private life is often like the dark side of the moon when you're looking at historical figures. You know it's there, its features are obscure, but this is where the novelist goes to work. The historian stops because he says we can't know. And the novelist has license to speculate, to recreate the inner life, if you can, but working with the best evidence that the historical record gives you.
I can remember Simon Sharma once saying that as a historian, he sometimes felt that he arrived on the scene just as his character was disappearing around a corner. But you give yourself the license to go around that corner and be with the character, as it were.
I am already round the corner.
You're there waiting with open arms.
Yes, I'm waiting with a camera.
So when were you first around that corner? When did you first encounter Thomas Cromwell? I mean, I wonder whether I'm alone in being the only person who first met him in A Man for All Seasons.
I think that's where I first met him too, years and years ago, when my younger brother was studying the play at school, and I undertook to do his homework because he wasn't going to do it for himself. That's what big sisters are for. And I suppose I bought into that version. Thomas More is 1960s liberal. Why not? He would have been outraged. Thomas Cromwell as his ruthless opponent. When I came to look at the record, if you think about it, because A Man for All Seasons is such good drama, and it genuinely is, it's held sway for two generations as a play and a film. There is another way of looking at it, though. Thomas Cromwell was not the dire enemy of Thomas More. and Moore's execution was not a victory for him. What would have been a victory for him would have been to get Moore to compromise and sign the Oath of Supremacy. The negotiations between them were tortuous. They lasted for weeks. And Thomas More said that Cromwell had shown himself my special tender friend. There's no reason to think he was being ironic. What Cromwell was trying to do was broker a compromise. It was the king who wouldn't have it. We have very good records of this time because Thomas More wrote everything down. And as soon as his conversations with Cromwell were done, he transcribed them and sent them home for safekeeping. We know a lot about the process, and it's not what we have come to believe over the generations. That was partly the preoccupation of Wolf Hall. And we move on here from the Thomas More story into the Anne Boleyn story.
Yes. That's Michael Cathcart from Books and Arts Daily on RN with Hilary Mantel and her new book, a sequel to the Booker Prize winner Wolf Hall. And she was speaking via a rather poor satellite link from London. Apologies for the quality.